am.
Lyra could see why Father Coram loved her, and why it was breaking his heart, though she had known neither of those things a moment before. He was growing old. He was an old, broken man, and she would be young for generations.
Have you got the symbol, reader?
Said the witch, in a voice so like the high, wild singing of the aurora itself that Lyra could hardly hear the sense for the sweet sound of it.
Yes, I got it in my pocket, safe.
Great Wingbeats told of another arrival, and then he was gliding beside her, the grey goose demon. He spoke briefly and then wheeled away to glide in a wide circle around the balloon as it continued to rise.
The Egyptians have laid waste to Bolvanger,
said Serafina Pekala.
They have killed 22 guards and 9 of the staff, and they've set light to every part of the buildings that still stood. They are going to destroy it completely.
What about Mrs. Coulter?
No sign of her.
And the kids? They got all the kids safely?
Every one. They are all safe.
Serafina Pekala cried out in a wild yell, and other witches circled and flew in towards the balloon.
Mr. Scoresby, the rope, if you please.
Ma'am, I'm very grateful. We're still rising. I guess we'll go on up a while yet. How many of you will it take to pull us north?
We are strong,
was all she said. Lee Scoresby was attaching a coil of stout rope to the leather-covered iron ring that gathered the ropes running over the gas bag, and from which the basket itself was suspended. When it was securely fixed, he threw the free end out, and at once 6 witches darted towards it, caught hold, and began to pull, urging the cloud pine branches towards the polar star. As the balloon began to move in that direction, Pantalaimon came to perch on the edge of the basket as a turn. Roger's demon came out to look, but crept back again soon, for Roger was fast asleep, as was Yorick Birnison. Only Lee Scoresby was awake, calmly chewing a thin cigar and watching his instruments.
So, Lyra, do you know why you're going to Lord Asriel?
Lyra was astonished.
To take him the alethiometer, of course.
She had never considered the question. It was obvious. Then she recalled her first motive from so long ago that she'd almost forgotten it.
Or to help him escape. That's it. We're going to help him get away.
But as she said that, it sounded absurd. Escape from Svalbard? Impossible.
Try, anyway. Why?
I think there are things I need to tell you.
About dust?
It was the first thing Lyra wanted to know.
Yes, among other things. But you are tired now, and it will be a long flight. We'll talk when you wake up.
Lyra yawned. It was a jaw-cracking, lung-bursting yawn that lasted almost a minute, or felt like it, and for all that Lyra struggled, she couldn't resist the onrush of sleep. Serafina Pekala reached a hand over the rim of the basket and touched her eyes, and as Lyra sank to the floor, Pantalaimon fluttered down, changed to an ermine, and crawled to his sleeping place by her neck. The witch settled her branch into a steady speed beside the basket as they moved north towards Svalbard.
That is the end of part 2 of Northern Lights. The astonishing conclusion to our story will be found in part 3, Svalbard. You've been listening to His Dark Materials, Book 1, Northern Lights, Part 2, Bolvanger, written and narrated by Philip Pullman. Featured in the cast were Joanna Wyatt as Lyra, Rupert Degas as Pantalaimon and Tony Costa, Sean Barrett as Yorick Birnison, Stephen Thorne as Father Coram, Douglas Blackwell as John Farr, and Andrew Branch as Kaiser and Abel Seaman Jerry. The role of Mrs. Coulter was performed by Alison Dowling, Martin Lansalius by Stephen Greif, and Michael Canzona by John O'Connor. Susan Sheridan played Serafina Pekala and Roger. Garrick Hagen was Lee Scoresby, and Liza Ross, the voice of Lee's demon. Annie was performed by Rachel Wolfe, Bella by Harriet Butler, Martha by Fiona Lamont, and Bridget by Anna Conan. The boys were Andrew Lamont, Alexander Mitchell, and Arthur Mitchell. Other roles were played by members of the cast. The executive producers of this recording were Timothy P. Ditlow and Bruce Coville. It was recorded at Heavy Entertainment Studios in London, England, where the engineer was Chris O'Shaughnessy. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. This has been a Story Circle production directed by Garrick Hagen for Listening Library and Chivas Audiobooks. We do hope you have enjoyed listening to this Chivas audiobook. Northern Lights, Part 3. Svalbard. What has gone before? Searching for the children stolen by the Oblation Board, Lyra Balakwa and the Egyptians, led by Farda Coram and John Farr, have travelled to the far north. In the town of Trollesen, they add two members to their band, Lee Scoresby, the Texas aeronaut, and Yorick Biernesen, the great armoured bear, who becomes Lyra's friend and protector after she organises his release from captivity. As the group pushes still farther north, Lyra consults the golden compass, from which she can read truth, and learns of a disturbing presence in a nearby village, a ghost child. Carried there by Yorick Biernesen, Lyra discovers something far more horrifying than a mere ghost. It is a child who has been cut away from his demon. Now that they are aware of what the Oblation Board is doing to the stolen children, their mission becomes all the more urgent, and all the more terrifying for Lyra herself, when she is captured and taken to the Oblation Board's northern fortress, Bolvanger, where she is in danger of being severed from her own beloved demon, Pantalaimon. Lyra's horror only increases when she learns that her mother, the coldly elegant Mrs. Coulter, is running Bolvanger. The only good news is that her friend Roger, whom she came north to seek to begin with, is still in the fortress and still intact. With the help of a free-flying demon linked to the witch Serafina Pekala, Lyra organizes an escape from Bolvanger. During the tremendous battle that follows, Lyra, Roger, and Yorick Biernesen are rescued by Lee Scoresby. With Serafina Pekala flying beside Scoresby's balloon, they continue northward, heading for Svalbard, the cliff-top fortress of the armored bears, to free Lyra's father, Lord Asriel, from captivity.
His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Book 1, Northern Lights. Part 3, Svalbard. Chapter 18, Fog and Ice. Lee Scoresby arranged some furs over Lyra. She curled up close to Roger and they lay together asleep as the balloon swept on towards the pole. The aeronaut checked his instruments from time to time, chewed on the cigar he would never light with the inflammable hydrogen so close, and huddled deeper into his own furs.
"This little girl's pretty important, huh?"
he said after several minutes.
"More than she will know,"
Serafina Pekala said.
"Does that mean there's going to be much in the way of armed pursuit? You understand I'm speaking as a practical man with a living to earn. I can't afford to get busted up or shot to pieces without some kind of compensation agreed to in advance. I ain't trying to lower the tone of this expedition, believe me, ma'am. But John Farr and the Egyptians paid me a fee that's enough to cover my time and skill and the normal wear and tear on the balloon, and that's all. It didn't include acts of war insurance. And let me tell you, ma'am, when we land Yorick Biernesen on Svalbard, that will count as an act of war."
He spat a piece of smoke leaf delicately overboard.
"So I'd like to know what we can expect in the way of mayhem and ructions."
"There may be fighting. But you have fought before."
"Sure, when I'm paid. But the fact is, I thought this was a straightforward transportation contract, and I charged according. And I'm a-wondering now, after that little dust-up down there, I'm a-wondering how far my transportation responsibility extends. Whether I'm bound to risk my life and my equipment in a war among the bears, for example. Or whether this little child has enemies on Svalbard as hot-tempered as the ones back at Bolvanger. I merely mention all this by way of making conversation."
"Mr. Scoresby, I wish I could answer your question. All I can say is that all of us, humans, witches, bears, are engaged in a war already,
although not all of us know it. Whether you find danger on Svalbard or whether you fly off unharmed, you are a recruit under arms, a soldier.
Well, that seems kind of precipitate. Seems to me a man should have a choice whether to take up arms or not.
We have no more choice in that than in whether or not to be born.
Oh, I like choice, though. I like choosing the jobs I take and the places I go and the food I eat and the companions I sit and yarn with. Don't you wish for a choice once in a while?
Serafina Pecula considered and then said,
Perhaps we don't mean the same thing by choice, Mr. Scoresby. Witches own nothing. So we're not interested in preserving value or making profits. And as for the choice between one thing and another, when you live for many hundreds of years, you know that every opportunity will come again. We have different needs. You have to repair your balloon and keep it in good condition, and that takes time and trouble, I see that. But for us to fly, all we have to do is tear off a branch of cloud pine. Any will do. And there are plenty more. We don't feel cold, so we need no warm clothes. We have no means of exchange apart from mutual aid. If a witch needs something, another witch will give it to her. If there is a war to be fought, we don't consider cost one of the factors in deciding whether or not it is right to fight. Nor do we have any notion of honour, as bears do, for instance. An insult to a bear is a deadly thing. To us, inconceivable. How could you insult a witch? What would it matter if you did?
Well, I'm kind of with you on that. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names ain't worth a quarrel. But, ma'am, you see my dilemma, I hope. I'm a simple aeronaut, and I'd like to end my days in comfort. Buy a little farm, a few head of cattle, some horses. Nothing grand, you notice? No palace or slaves or heaps of gold. Just the evening wind over the sage and a cigar and a glass of bourbon whiskey. Now, the trouble is that costs money. So I do my flying in exchange for cash. And after every job, I send some gold back to the Wells Fargo Bank. And when I've got enough, ma'am, I'm going to sell this balloon and book me a passage on a steamer to Port Galveston. And I'll never leave the ground again.
There's another difference between us, Mr. Scoresby. A witch would no sooner give up flying than give up breathing. To fly is to be perfectly ourselves.
I see that, ma'am, and I envy you. But I ain't got your sources of satisfaction. Flying is just a job to me, and I'm just a technician. I might as well be adjusting valves in a gas engine or wiring up anbaric circuits. But I chose it, you see. It was my own free choice. Which is why I find this notion of a war I ain't been told nothing about kind of troubling.
Yorick Bernison's quarrel with his king is part of it, too. This child is destined to play a part in that.
You speak of destiny as if it was fixed, and I ain't sure I like that any more than a war I'm enlisted in without knowing about it. Where's my free will, if you please? And this child seems to me to have more free will than anyone I ever met. Are you telling me that she's just some kind of clockwork toy wound up and set going on a course she can't change?
We are all subject to the fates, but we must all act as if we are not, or die of despair. There is a curious prophecy about this child. She is destined to bring about the end of destiny, but she must do so without knowing what she is doing, as if it were her nature and not her destiny to do it. If she's told what she must do, it will all fail. Death will sweep through all the worlds. It will be the triumph of despair forever. The universes will all become nothing more than interlocking machines, blind and empty of thought, feeling, life.
They looked down at Lyra, whose sleeping face, what little of it they could see inside her hood, wore a stubborn little frown.
I guess part of her knows that. Looks prepared for it anyways. How about the little boy? You know she came all this way to save him from those fiends back there? They were playmates, back in Oxford or somewhere. Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that. Lyra is carrying something of immense value, and it seems that the Fates are using her as a messenger to take it to her father. So she came all this way to find her friend, not knowing that her friend was brought to the north by the Fates, in order that she might follow and bring something to her father.
That's how you read it, huh?
For the first time, the witch seemed unsure.
That is how it seems. But we can't read the darkness, Mr. Scoresby. It is more than possible that I might be wrong.
And what brought you into all this, if I can ask?
Whatever they were doing at Bolvanger, we felt it was wrong with all our hearts. Lyra is their enemy, so we are her friends. We don't see more clearly than that. But also there is my clan's friendship for the Egyptian people, which goes back to the time when Father Coram saved my life. We are doing this at their bidding. And they have ties of obligation with Lord Asriel.
I see. So you're towing the balloon to Svalbard for the Egyptians' sake. And does that friendship extend to towing us back again, or will I have to wait for a kindly wind and depend on the intelligence of the bears in the meantime? Once again, ma'am, I'm asking merely in a spirit of friendly inquiry.
If we can help you back to Trollesund, Mr. Scoresby, we shall do so. But we don't know what we shall meet on Svalbard. The bear's new king has made many changes. The old ways are out of favor. It might be a difficult landing. And I don't know how Lyra will find her way to her father. Nor do I know what Eorig Bjørnason has it in mind to do, except that his fate is involved with hers.
I don't know either, ma'am. I think he's attached himself to the little girl as a kind of protector. She helped him get his armor back, you see. Who knows what bears feel, but if a bear ever loved a human being, he loves her. As for landing on Svalbard, it's never been easy. Still, if I can call on you for a tug in the right direction, I'll feel kind of easier in my mind. And if there's anything I can do for you in return, you only have to say. But just so as I know, would you mind telling me whose side I'm on in this invisible war?
We are both on Lyra's side.
Oh, no doubt about that.
They flew on. Because of the clouds below, there was no way of telling how fast they were going. Normally, of course, the balloon remained still with respect to the wind, floating at whatever speed the air itself was moving. But now, pulled by the witches, the balloon was moving through the air instead of with it, and resisting the movement, too, because the unwieldy gas bag had none of the streamlined smoothness of a zeppelin. As a result, the basket swung this way and that, rocking and bumping much more than on a normal flight. Lee Scoresby wasn't concerned for his comfort so much as for his instruments, and he spent some time making sure they were securely lashed to the main struts. According to the altimeter, they were nearly 10,000 feet up. The temperature was minus 20 degrees. He had been colder than this, but not much, and he didn't want to get any colder now. So he unrolled the canvas sheet he used as an emergency bivouac and spread it in front of the sleeping children to keep off the wind, before lying down back to back with his old comrade in arms, Eorig Bjørnason, and falling asleep. When Lyra woke up, the moon was high in the sky, and everything in sight was silver-plated, from the roiling surface of the clouds below to the frost spears and icicles on the rigging of the balloon. Roger was sleeping, and so were Lee Scoresby and the bear. Beside the basket, however, the Witch Queen was flying steadily.
How far are we from Svalbard?
Lyra said.
If we meet no winds, we shall be over Svalbard in 12 hours or so.
Where are we going to land?
It depends on the weather. We'll try to avoid the cliffs, though. There are creatures living there who prey on anything that moves. If we can, we'll set you down in the interior, away from Jofur Ragnarsson's palace.
What's going to happen when I find Lord Asriel? Will he want to come back to Oxford or what? I don't know if I ought to tell him I know he's my father, neither. He might want to pretend he's still my uncle. I don't hardly know him at all.
He won't want to go back to Oxford, Lyra.
It seems that there is something to be done in another world, and Lord Asriel is the only one who can bridge the gulf between that world and this. But he needs something to help him.
The alethiometer! The Master of Jordan gave it to me, and I thought there was something he wanted to say about Lord Asriel, except he never had the chance. I knew he didn't really want to poison him. Is he going to read it and see how to make the bridge? I bet I could help him. I can probably read it as good as anyone now.
I don't know. How he'll do it and what his task will be, we can't tell. There are powers who speak to us, and there are powers above them. And there are secrets even from the Most High.
The alethiometer would tell me. I could read it now.
But it was too cold. She would never have managed to hold it. She bundled herself up and pulled the hood tight against the chill of the wind, leaving only a slit to look through. Far ahead, and a little below, the long rope extended from the suspension ring of the balloon, pulled by 6 or 7 witches sitting on their cloud pine branches. The stars shone as bright and cold and hard as diamonds.
Why aren't you cold, Seraphina Pecola?
We feel cold, but we don't mind it, because we will not come to harm. And if we wrapped up against the cold, we wouldn't feel other things like the bright tingle of the stars, or the music of the aurora, or best of all, the silky feeling of moonlight on our skin. It's worth being cold for that.
Could I feel them?
No. You would die if you took your furs off. Stay wrapped up.
How long do witches live, Seraphina Piccola? Father Decorum says hundreds of years, but you don't look old at all.
I am 300 years or more. Our oldest witch mother is nearly 1,000. One day, Yambe Aka will come for her. One day, she'll come for me. She is the goddess of the dead. She comes to you smiling and kindly, and you know it is time to die.
Are there men witches, or only women?
There are men who serve us, like the consul at Trollisund, and there are men we take for lovers or husbands. You are so young, Lyra, too young to understand this. But I shall tell you anyway, and you'll understand it later. Men pass in front of our eyes like butterflies, creatures of a brief season. We love them. They are brave, proud, beautiful, clever. And they die almost at once. They die so soon that our hearts are continually racked with pain. We bear their children, who are witches if they are female, human if not. And then in the blink of an eye, they are gone, felled, slain, lost. Our sons, too. When a little boy is growing, he thinks he is immortal. His mother knows he isn't. Each time becomes more painful, until finally your heart is broken. Perhaps that is when Yambe Aka comes for you. She is older than the tundra. Perhaps for her, witches' lives are as brief as men's are to us.
Did you love Father Decorum?
Yes. Does he know that?
I don't know, but I know he loves you.
When he rescued me, he was young and strong and full of pride and beauty. I loved him at once. I would have changed my nature. I would have forsaken the star tingle and the music of the aurora. I would never have flown again. I would have given all that up in a moment, without a thought, to be Egyptian boatwife and cook for him and share his bed and bear his children. But you cannot change what you are, only what you do. I am a witch. He is a human. I stayed with him for long enough to bear him a child.
He never said. Was it a girl? A witch?
No, a boy. And he died in the great epidemic of 40 years ago, the sickness that came out of the East. Poor little child. He flickered into life and out of it like a mayfly. And it tore pieces out of my heart, as it always does. It broke Corum's. And then the call came for me to return to my own people, because Yambe Aka had taken my mother and I was clan queen. So I left, as I had to.
Did you never see Far Decorum again?
Never. I heard of his deeds. I heard how he was wounded by the Skraelings with a poisoned arrow, and I sent herbs and spells to help him recover. But I wasn't strong enough to see him. I heard how broken he was after that, and how his wisdom grew, how much he studied and read, and I was proud of him and his goodness. But I stayed away, for they were dangerous times for my clan, and witch wars were threatening. And besides, I thought he would forget me and find a human wife.
He never would. You ought to go and see him. He still loves you, I know he does.
But he would be ashamed of his own age, and I wouldn't want to make him feel that.
Perhaps he would, but you ought to send a message to him at least. That's what I think.
Seraphina Pekela said nothing for a long time. Pantalaimon became a tern and flew to her branch for a second to acknowledge that perhaps they had been insolent. Then Lyra said,
"Why do people have demons, Seraphina Pekela?"
"Everyone asks that, and no one knows the answer. As long as there have been human beings, they have had demons. It's what makes us different from animals."
"Yeah, we're different from them, all right. Like bears. They're strange, aren't they, bears? You think they're like a person, and then suddenly they do something so strange or ferocious you think you'll never understand them. But you know what Yorick said to me? He said that his armor for him was like what a demon is for a person. It's his soul, he said. But that's where they're different again, because he made this armor himself. They took his first armor away when they sent him into exile, and he found some sky iron and made some new armor, like making a new soul. We can't make our demons. Then the people at Trollison, they got him drunk on spirits and stole it away. And I found out where it was, and he got it back. But what I wonder is, why is he coming to Svalbard? They'll fight him. They might kill him. I love Yorick. I love him so much, I wish he wasn't coming.
Has he told you who he is?
Only his name, and it was the consul at Trollison who told us that.
He is highborn. He is a prince. In fact, if he had not committed a great crime, he would be the king of the bears by now.
He told me their king was called Jofur Ragnarsson.
Jofur Ragnarsson became king when Yorick Birnason was exiled. Jofur is a prince, of course, so he wouldn't be allowed to rule. But he is clever in a human way. He makes alliances and treaties. He lives not as bears do, in ice forts, but in a new-built palace. He talks of exchanging ambassadors with human nations and developing the fire mines with the help of human engineers. He is very skillful and subtle. Some say that he provoked Yorick into the deed for which he was exiled. And others say that even if he didn't, he encourages them to think he did, because it adds to his reputation for craft and subtlety.
What did Yorick do? See, one reason I love Yorick is because of my father doing what he did and being punished. Seems to me they're like each other. Yorick told me he'd killed another bear, but he never said how it came about.
The fight was over a she-bear. The male whom Yorick killed would not display the usual signs of surrender when it was clear that Yorick was stronger. For all their pride, bears never fail to recognize superior force in another bear and surrender to it. But for some reason, this bear didn't do it. Some say that Jofur Ragnarsson worked on his mind or gave him confusing herbs to eat. At any rate, the young bear persisted, and Yorick Birnason allowed his temper to master him. The case was not hard to judge. He should have wounded, not killed.
So, otherwise, he'd be king. And I heard something about Jofur Ragnarsson from the Palmerian professor at Jordan, because he'd been to the north and met him. He said, oh, I wish I could remember what it was. I think he tricked his way onto the throne or something. But you know, Yorick said to me once that bears couldn't be tricked, and showed me that I couldn't trick him. It sounds as if they was both tricked, him and the other bear. Maybe only bears can trick bears. Maybe people can't. Except the people at Trollison, they tricked him, didn't they? When they got him drunk and stole his armor.
When bears act like people, perhaps they can be tricked. When bears act like bears, perhaps they can't. No bear would normally drink spirits. Yorick Birnason drank to forget the shame of exile, and it was only that which let the Trollison people trick him.
Ah, yes,
said Lyra, nodding. She was satisfied with that idea. She admired Yorick almost without limit, and she was glad to find confirmation of his nobility.
That's clever of you. I wouldn't have known that if you hadn't told me. I think you're probably cleverer than Mrs. Coulter.
They flew on. Lyra chewed some of the seal meat she found in her pocket.
Seraphina Piccola,
she said after some time,
what's dust? Because it seems to me that all this trouble's about dust, only no one's told me what it is.
I don't know. Witches have never worried about dust. All I can tell you is that where there are priests, there is fear of dust. Mrs. Coulter is not a priest, of course, but she is a powerful agent of the Magisterium, and it was she who set up the oblation board and persuaded the church to pay for Bolvanga because of her interest in dust. We can't understand her feelings about it, but there are many things we have never understood. We see the Tartars making holes in their skulls, and we can only wonder at the strangeness of it. So, dust may be strange, and we wonder at it, but we don't fret and tear things apart to examine it. Leave that to the church.
The church?
Said Lyra. Something had come back to her. She remembered talking with Pantalaimon in the Fens about what it might be that was moving the needle of the alethiometer, and they had thought of the photo mill on the high altar at Gabriel College, and how elementary particles pushed the little veins around. The intercessor there was clear about the link between elementary particles and religion.
Could be,
she said, nodding.
Most church things, they keep secret after all. But most church things are old, and dust ain't old as far as I know. I wonder if Lord Asriel might tell me.
She yawned.
I better lie down, else I'll probably freeze. I've been cold down on the ground, but I've never been this cold. I think I might die if I get any colder.
Then lie down and wrap yourself in the furs.
Yeah, I will. If I was going to die, I'd rather die up here than down there any day. I thought when they put us under that blade thing, I thought that was it. We both did. Oh, that was cruel. But we'll lie down now. Wake us up when we get there,
she said, and got down on the pile of furs, clumsy and aching in every part of her with the profound intensity of the cold, and lay as close as she could to the sleeping Roger. And so the four travellers sailed on, sleeping in the ice-encrusted balloon, towards the rocks and glaciers, the fire mines and the ice forts of Svalbard. Seraphina Pekela called to the aeronaut and he woke at once, groggy with cold, but aware from the movement of the basket that something was wrong. It was swinging wildly as strong winds buffeted the gas bag, and the witches pulling the rope were barely managing to hold it. If they let go, the balloon would be swept off course at once, and to judge by his glance at the compass, would be swept towards Nova Zembla at nearly 100 miles an hour.
Where are we?
Lyra heard him call. She was half waking herself, uneasy because of the motion, and so cold that every part of her body was numb. She couldn't hear the witch's reply, but through her half-closed hood she saw, in the light of an Anbaric lantern, Lee Scoresby hold onto a strut and pull at a rope leading up into the gas bag itself. He gave a sharp tug as if against some obstruction, and looked up into the buffeting dark before looping the rope around a cleat on the suspension ring.
I'm letting out some gas,
he shouted to Seraphina Pekela.
We'll go down, we're way too high.
The witch called something in return, but again Lyra couldn't hear it. Roger was waking too. The creaking of the basket was enough to wake the deepest sleeper, never mind the rocking and bumping. Roger's demon and Pantalaimon clung together like marmosets, and Lyra concentrated on lying still and not leaping up in fear.
Sure, right,
Roger said, sounding much more cheerful than she was.
Soon as we get down, we can make a fire and get warm. I got some matches in me pocket. I pinched them out the kitchen at Bolvanga.
The balloon was certainly descending because they were enveloped a second later in thick, freezing cloud. Scraps and wisps of it flew through the basket, and then everything was obscured all at once. It was like the thickest fog Lyra had ever known. After a moment or two, there came another cry from Seraphina Pekela, and the aeronaut unlooped the rope from the cleat and let go. It sprang upward through his hands, and even over the creak and the buffeting and the howl of wind through the rigging, Lyra heard or felt a mighty thump from somewhere far above. Lee Scoresby saw her wide eyes.
That's the gas valve! It works on a spring to hold the gas in. When I pull it down, some gas escapes out of the top, and we lose buoyancy and go down.
Are we nearly?
She didn't finish because something hideous happened. A creature half the size of a man, with leathery wings and hooked claws, was crawling over the side of the basket towards Lee Scoresby. It had a flat head with bulging eyes and a wide frog mouth, and from it came wafts of abominable stink. Lyra had no time to scream, even, before Yorick Bernison reached up and cuffed it away. It fell out of the basket and vanished with a shriek.
"Cliffgast,"
said Yorick briefly. The next moment Serafina Pekala appeared and clung to the side of the basket, speaking urgently.
"The Cliffgasts are attacking! We'll bring the balloon to the ground, and then we must defend ourselves. They're..."
But Lyra didn't hear the rest of what she said, because there was a rending, ripping sound and everything tilted sideways. Then a terrific blow hurled the three humans against the side of the balloon where Yorick Bernison's armor was stacked. Yorick put out a great paw to hold them in because the basket was jolting so violently. Serafina Pekala had vanished. The noise was appalling. Over every other sound there came the shrieking of the Cliffgasts, and Lyra saw them hurtling past and smelled their foul stench. Then there came another jerk, so sudden that it threw them all to the floor again, and the basket began to sink with frightening speed, spinning all the while. It felt as if they had torn loose from the balloon and were dropping unchecked by anything. And then came another series of jerks and crashes, the basket being tossed rapidly from side to side as if they were bouncing between rock walls. The last thing Lyra saw was Lee Scoresby firing his long-barreled pistol directly in the face of a Cliffgast, and then she shut her eyes tight and clung to Yorick Bernison's fur with passionate fear. Howls, shrieks, the lash and whistle of the wind, the creak of the basket like a tormented animal, all filled the wild air with hideous noise. Then came the biggest jolt of all, and she found herself hurled out altogether. Her grip was torn loose, and all the breath was knocked out of her lungs as she landed in such a tangle that she couldn't tell which way was up. And her face and the tight-pulled hood was full of powder, dry, cold, crystals. It was snow. She had landed in a snowdrift. She was so battered that she could hardly think. She lay quite still for several seconds before feebly spitting out the snow in her mouth, and then she blew just as feebly until there was a little space to breathe in. Nothing seemed to be hurting in particular. She just felt utterly breathless. Cautiously she tried to move hands, feet, arms, legs, and to raise her head. She could see very little because her hood was still filled with snow. With an effort, as if her hands weighed a ton each, she brushed it off and peered out. She saw a world of grey, of pale greys and dark greys and blacks, where fog drifts wandered like wraiths. The only sounds she could hear were the distant cries of the Cliffgasts high above and the crash of waves on rocks some way off.
"Yorick!"
she cried. Her voice was faint and shaky, and she tried again, but no one answered. She called, with the same result. She might have been alone in the world, but of course she never was. A pantalaimon crept out of her anorak as a mouse to keep her company.
"I've checked the alethiometer, and it's all right. Nothing's broken."
"We're lost, Pan. Did you see those Cliffgasts? And Mr. Scoresby shooting 'em? God help us if they come down here.
We better try and find the basket. Maybe. We better not call out. I did just now, but maybe I better not in case they hear us. I wish I knew where we were."
"We might not like it if we did. We might be at the bottom of a cliff with no way up, and the Cliffgasts at the top to see us where the fog clears."
She felt around once she had rested a few more minutes and found that she had landed in a gap between two ice-covered rocks. Freezing fog covered everything. To one side there was the crash of waves about 50 yards off by the sound of it, and from high above there still came the shrieking of the Cliffgasts, though that seemed to be abating a little. She could see no more than 2 or 3 yards in the murk, and even Pantalaimon's owl eyes were helpless. She made her way painfully, slipping and sliding on the rough rocks, away from the waves and up the beach a little, and found nothing but rock and snow, and no sign of the balloon or any of the occupants.
"They can't have all just vanished."
Pantalaimon prowled, cat-formed, a little further afield, and came across 4 heavy sandbags broken open, with the scattered sand already freezing hard.
"Ballast! He must have slung them off to fly up again."
She swallowed hard to subdue the lump in her throat, or the fear in her breast, or both.
"Oh, God, I'm frightened. I hope they're safe."
Pantalaimon came to her arms, and then, mouse-formed, crept into her hood where he couldn't be seen. She heard a noise, something scraping on rock, and turned to see what it was. But she choked the word back unfinished, for it wasn't Yorick Bernison at all. It was a strange bear, clad in polished armour with the dew on it frozen into frost, and with a plume in his helmet. He stood still about 6 feet away, and she thought she really was finished. The bear opened his mouth and roared. An echo came back from the cliffs and stirred more shrieking from far above. Out of the fog came another bear and another. Lyra stood still, clenching her little human fists. The bears didn't move until the first one said,
"Your name?"
"Lyra."
"Where have you come from?"
"The sky."
"In a balloon?"
"Yes."
"Come with us. You are a prisoner. Move, now, quickly."
Weary and scared, Lyra began to stumble over the harsh and slippery rocks, following the bear, wondering how she could talk her way out of this. Chapter 19. Captivity. The bears took Lyra up a gully in the cliffs, where the fog lay even more thickly than on the shore. The cries of the cliff ghasts and the crash of the waves grew fainter as they climbed, and presently the only sound was the ceaseless crying of seabirds. They clambered in silence over rocks and snowdrifts, and although Lyra peered wide-eyed into the enfolding greyness and strained her ears for the sound of her friends, she might have been the only human on Svalbard, and Yorick might have been dead. The bear sergeant said nothing to her until they were on level ground. There they stopped. From the sound of the waves, Lyra judged them to have reached the top of the cliffs, and she dared not run away in case she fell over the edge.
"Look up,"
said the bear, as a waft of breeze moved aside the heavy curtain of the fog. There was little daylight in any case, but Lyra did look and found herself standing in front of a vast building of stone. It was as tall at least as the highest part of Jordan College, but much more massive, and carved all over with representations of warfare, showing bears victorious and Skraeling surrendering, showing Tartars chained and slaving in the fire mines, showing zeppelins flying from all parts of the world bearing gifts and tributes to the king of the bears, Jofur Ragnarsson. At least, that was what the bear sergeant told her the carving showed. She had to take his word for it, because every projection and ledge on the deeply sculpted façade was occupied by gannets and skuas, which cawed and shrieked and wheeled constantly round overhead, and whose droppings had coated every part of the building with thick smears of dirty white. The bears seemed not to see the mess, however, and they led the way in through the huge arch, over the icy ground that was filthy with the spatter of the birds. There was a courtyard, and high steps and gateways, and at every point bears in armour challenged the incomers and were given a password. Their armour was polished and gleaming, and they all wore plumes in their helmets. Lyra couldn't help comparing every bear she saw with Yorick Birnison, and always to his advantage. He was more powerful, more graceful, and his armour was real armour, rust-coloured, blood-stained, dented with combat, not elegant, enamelled, and decorative like most of what she saw around her now. As they went further in, the temperature rose, and so did something else. The smell in Jofur's palace was repulsive. Rancid seal fat, dung, blood, refuse of every sort. Lyra pushed back her hood to be cooler, but she couldn't help wrinkling her nose. She hoped bears couldn't read human expressions. There were iron brackets every few yards, holding blubber lamps, and in their flaring shadows it wasn't always easy to see where she was treading, either. Finally they stopped outside a heavy door of iron. A guard bear pulled back a massive bolt, and the sergeant suddenly swung his paw at Lyra, knocking her head over heels through the doorway. Before she could scramble up, she heard the door being bolted behind her. It was profoundly dark, but Pantalaimon became a firefly and shed a tiny glow around them. They were in a narrow cell where the walls dripped with damp, and there was one stone bench for furniture. In the farthest corner there was a heap of rags she took for bedding, and that was all she could see. Lyra sat down, with Pantalaimon on her shoulder, and felt in her clothes for the alethiometer.
"It certainly had a lot of banging about, Pan. I hope it still works."
Pantalaimon flew down to her wrist and sat there glowing while Lyra composed her mind. With a part of her, she found it remarkable that she could sit here in terrible danger and yet sink into the calm she needed to read the alethiometer. And yet it was so much a part of her now that the most complicated questions sorted themselves out into their constituent symbols as naturally as her muscles moved her limbs. She hardly had to think about them. She turned the hands and thought the question.
"Where is Yorick?"
The answer came at once.
"A day's journey away, carried there by the balloon after your crash, but hurrying this way."
"And Roger?"
"With Yorick."
"What will Yorick do?"
"He intends to break into the palace and rescue you in the face of all the difficulties."
She put the alethiometer away, even more anxious than before.
"They won't let him, will they?"
she said to Pantalaimon.
"There's too many of him. I wish I was a witch, Pan. Then you could go off and find him and take messages and all, and we could make a proper plan."
Then she had the fright of her life. A man's voice spoke in the darkness a few feet away and said,
"Who are you?"
She leaped up with a cry of alarm. Pantalaimon became a bat at once, shrieking, and flew around her head as she backed against the wall.
Who is that? Speak up! Speak up!
Be a firefly again, Pan, but don't go too close.
The little wavering point of light danced through the air and fluttered around the head of the speaker. And it hadn't been a heap of rags after all. It was a grey-bearded man, chained to the wall, whose eyes glittered in Pantalaimon's luminance, and whose tattered hair hung over his shoulders. His demon, a weary-looking serpent, lay in his lap, flicking out her tongue occasionally as Pantalaimon flew near.
What's your name?
Jotham Sangelia. I am the Regius Professor of Cosmology at the University of Gloucester. Who are you?
Lyra Belacqua. What have they locked you up for?
Malice and jealousy. Where do you come from, eh?
From Jordan College.
What? Oxford?
Yes.
Is that scoundrel Trelawney still there, eh?
The Palmerian professor? Yes.
Is he, by God, eh? They should have forced his resignation long ago. Duplicitous plagiarist. Coxcomb.
Lyra made a neutral sound.
Has he published his paper on gamma-ray photons yet?
The professor said, thrusting his face up towards Lyra's. She moved back.
I don't know,
she said, and then, making it up out of pure habit.
No. I remember now. He said he still needed to check some figures, and he said he was going to write about dust as well. That's it.
Scoundrel! Thief! Blackguard! Rogue!
Shouted the old man, and he shook so violently that Lyra was afraid he'd have a fit. His demon slithered lethargically off his lap as the professor beat his fists against his shanks. Drops of saliva flew out of his mouth.
Yeah, I always thought he was a thief, and a rogue and all that.
If it was unlikely for a scruffy little girl to turn up in his cell knowing the very man who figured in his obsessions, the Regius Professor didn't notice. He was mad, and no wonder, poor old man. But he might have some scraps of information that Lyra could use. She sat carefully near him, not near enough for him to touch, but near enough for Pantalaimon's tiny light to show him clearly.
One thing Professor Trelawney used to boast about was how well he knew the King of the Bears.
Boast? Well, I should say he boasts. He's nothing but a popinjay and a pirate. Not a scrap of original research to his name. Everything filched from better men.
Yeah, that's right. And when he does do something of his own, he gets it wrong.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No talent, no imagination, a fraud from top to bottom.
I mean, for example, I bet you know more about the bears than he does for a start.
Bears? Oh, I could write a treatise on them. That's why they shut me away, you know.
Why's that?
I know too much about them, and they daren't kill me. Oh, they daren't do it, much as they'd like to. I know, you see. I have friends. Yes, powerful friends.
Yeah, and I bet you'd be a wonderful teacher, being as you've got so much knowledge and experience.
Even in the depths of his madness, a little common sense still flickered, and he looked at her sharply, almost as if he suspected her of sarcasm. But she had been dealing with suspicious and cranky scholars all her life, and she gazed back with such bland admiration that he was soothed.
Teacher! Teacher! Yes, I could teach. Give me the right pupil, and I will light a fire in his mind.
Because your knowledge ought not to just vanish. It ought to be passed on so people remember you.
Yes,
he said, nodding seriously.
That's very perceptive of you, child. What is your name?
Lyra, could you teach me about the bears?
The bears?
I'd really like to know about cosmology and dust and all, but I'm not clever enough for that. You need really clever students for that. But I could learn about the bears. You could teach me about them, all right. And we could sort of practice on that and work up to dust, maybe.
Yes. Yes. I believe you're right. There is a correspondence between the microcosm and the macrocosm. The stars are alive, child. Did you know that? Everything out there is alive. And there are grand purposes abroad. The universe is full of intentions, you know. Everything happens for a purpose. Your purpose is to remind me of that. Good, good. In my despair, I had forgotten. Good. Excellent, my child.
So, Have you seen the king, Jofur Ragnarsson?
Oh, yes. I came here at his invitation, you know. He intended to set up a university. He was going to make me vice-chancellor. That put me one in the eye for the Royal Arctic Institute. Eh? And that scoundrel Trelawney. Ha!
What happened?
I was betrayed by lesser men. Trelawney among them, of course. He was here, you know, on Svalbard. Spread lies and calumny about my qualifications. Calumny! Slander! Who was it discovered the final proof of the Barnard-Stokes hypothesis? Eh? Eh? Yes, Santelia, that's who. Trelawney couldn't take it. Lied through his teeth. Jofur Ragnarsson had me thrown in here. Oh, I'll be out one day, you'll see. I'll be vice-chancellor. Oh, yes. Let Trelawney come to me then, begging for mercy. Let the Publications Committee of the Royal Arctic Institute spurn my contributions then. Ha! I'll expose them all.
I expect Yorick Bernison will believe you when he comes back.
Yorick Bernison? No good waiting for that. He'll never come back.
He's on his way now.
Then they'll kill him. He's not a bear, you see. He's an outcast, like me. Degraded, you see. Not entitled to any of the privileges of a bear.
Supposing Yorick Bernison did come back, though. Supposing he challenged Jofur Ragnarsson to a fight.
Oh, they wouldn't allow it. Jofur would never lower himself to acknowledge Yorick Bernison's right to fight him. Hasn't got a right. Yorick might as well be a seal now, or a walrus, not a bear. Or worse, Tartar, or Skraeling. They wouldn't fight him honourably like a bear. They'd kill him with fire hurlers before he got near. Not a hope. No mercy.
Oh,
said Lyra with a heavy despair in her breast.
And what about the bear's other prisoners? Do you know where they keep them?
Other prisoners?
Like Lord Asriel.
Suddenly the professor's manner changed altogether. He cringed and shrank back against the wall and shook his head warningly.
Shh! Quiet! They'll hear you!
Oh, why mustn't we mention Lord Asriel?
Forbidden! Very dangerous! Jofur Ragnarsson will not allow him to be mentioned.
Why?
Lyra said, coming closer and whispering herself so as not to alarm him.
Keeping Lord Asriel prisoner is a special charge laid on Jofur by the Oblation Board. Mrs. Coulter herself came here to see Jofur and offered him all kinds of rewards to keep Lord Asriel out of the way. I know about it, you see, because at the time I was in Jofur's favour myself. I met Mrs. Coulter, yes, had a long conversation with her. Jofur was besotted with her, couldn't stop talking about her, would do anything for her. If she wants Lord Asriel kept 100 miles away, that's what will happen. Anything for Mrs. Coulter. Anything. He's going to name his capital city after her. Did you know that?
So he wouldn't let anyone go and see Lord Asriel?
No, never. But he's afraid of Lord Asriel too, you know. Jofur's playing a difficult game. But he's clever. He's done what they both want. He's kept Lord Asriel isolated to please Mrs. Coulter. And he's let Lord Asriel have all the equipment he wants to please him. Oh, can't last. This equilibrium. Unstable. Pleasing both sides, eh? The wave function of this situation is going to collapse quite soon. I have it on good authority.
Really?
Said Lyra, her mind elsewhere, furiously thinking about what he just said.
Yes. My demon's tongue can taste probability, you know.
Yeah, mine too. When do they feed us, Professor?
Feed us?
Well, they must put some food in sometime, else we'd starve. And there's bones on the floor. I expect they're seal bones, aren't they?
Seal? I don't know. It might be.
Lyra got up and felt her way to the door. There was no handle, naturally, and no keyhole. And it fitted so closely at top and bottom that no light showed. She pressed her ear to it, but heard nothing. Behind her, the old man was muttering to himself. She heard his chain rattle as he turned over wearily and lay the other way, and presently he began to snore. She felt her way back to the bench. Pantalaimon, tired of putting out light, had become a bat, which was all very well for him. He fluttered around, squeaking quietly while Lyra sat and chewed a fingernail. Quite suddenly, with no warning at all, she remembered what it was that she'd heard the Palmyrian professor saying in the retiring room all that time ago. Something had been nagging at her ever since Yorick Bernison had first mentioned Joffo's name, and now it came back. What Joffo Ragnarsson wanted more than anything else, Professor Trelawney had said, was a demon. Of course, she hadn't understood what he meant. He'd spoken of Panserbjörner instead of using the English word, so she didn't know he was talking about bears, and she had no idea that Joffo Ragnarsson wasn't a man. And a man would have had a demon anyway, so it hadn't made sense. But now it was plain. Everything she'd heard about the Bear King added up. The mighty Joffo Ragnarsson wanted nothing more than to be a human being, with a demon of his own. And as she thought that, a plan came to her. A way of making Joffo Ragnarsson do what he would normally never have done. A way of restoring Yorick Bernison to his rightful throne. A way, finally, of getting to the place where they had put Lord Asriel, and taking him the alethiometer. The idea hovered and shimmered delicately like a soap bubble, and she dared not even look at it directly in case it burst. But she was familiar with the way of ideas, and she let it shimmer, looking away, thinking about something else. She was nearly asleep when the bolts clattered and the door opened. Light spilled in, and she was on her feet at once, with Pantalaimon hidden swiftly in her pocket. As soon as the bear guard bent his head to lift the haunch of seal meat and throw it in, she was at his side, saying,
"Take me to Joffo Ragnarsson. You'll be in trouble if you don't. It's very urgent."
He dropped the meat from his jaws and looked up. It wasn't easy to read Bear's expressions, but he looked angry.
"It's about Yorick Bernison. I know something about him, and the king needs to know."
"Tell me what it is, and I'll pass the message on."
"That wouldn't be right. Not for someone else to know before the king does. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but you see, it's the rule that the king has to know things first."
Perhaps he was slow-witted. At any rate, he paused and then threw the meat into the cell before saying,
"Very well. You come with me."
He led her out into the open air, for which she was grateful. The fog had lifted, and there were stars glittering above the high-walled courtyard. The guard conferred with another bear who came to speak to her.
"You cannot see Joffo Ragnarsson when you please. You have to wait till he wants to see you."
"But this is urgent, what I've got to tell him. It's about Yorick Bernison. I'm sure His Majesty would want to know it, but all the same I can't tell it to anyone else, don't you see? It wouldn't be polite. He'd be ever so cross if he knew we hadn't been polite."
That seemed to carry some weight, or else to mystify the bear sufficiently to make him pause. Lyra was sure her interpretation of things was right. Joffo Ragnarsson was introducing so many new ways that none of the bears was certain yet how to behave, and she could exploit this uncertainty in order to get to Joffo. So that bear retreated to consult the bear above him, and before long Lyra was ushered inside the palace again, but into the state quarters this time. It was no cleaner here, and in fact the air was even harder to breathe than in the cell, because all the natural stinks had been overlaid by a heavy layer of cloying perfume. She was made to wait in a corridor, then in an anteroom, then outside a large door, while bears discussed and argued and scurried back and forth, and she had time to look around at the preposterous decoration. The walls were rich with gilt plasterwork, some of which was already peeling off or crumbling with damp, and the florid carpets were trodden with filth. Finally, the large door was opened from the inside. A blaze of light from half a dozen chandeliers, a crimson carpet, and more of that thick perfume hanging in the air. And the faces of a dozen or more bears, all gazing at her, none in armor, but each with some kind of decoration. A golden necklace, a headdress of purple feathers, a crimson sash. Curiously, the room was also occupied by birds. Terns and skuas perched on the plaster cornice and swooped low to snatch at bits of fish that had fallen out of one another's nests in the chandeliers. And on a dais at the far end of the room, a mighty throne reared up high. It was made of granite for strength and massiveness, but like so many other things in Joffo's palace, it was decorated with over-elaborate swags and festoons of gilt that looked like tinsel on a mountainside. Sitting on the throne was the biggest bear she had ever seen. Joffo Ragnarsson was even taller and bulkier than Yorick, and his face was much more mobile and expressive, with a kind of humanness in it which she had never seen in Yorick's. When Joffo looked at her, she seemed to see a man looking out of his eyes, the sort of man she had met at Mrs. Coulter's, a subtle politician used to power. He was wearing a heavy gold chain around his neck, with a gaudy jewel hanging from it, and his claws, a good 6 inches long, were each covered in gold leaf. The effect was one of enormous strength and energy and craft. He was quite big enough to carry the absurd over-decoration. On him it didn't look preposterous, it looked barbaric and magnificent.